February 8th, 1919. The public lectures that have just been given were concerned with the social problem, the social demands of the present time. However, our way of considering these has been not only in the form of thoughts, responding to observation, but we have looked at these demands as facts, as happenings belonging to the present-day global scene. It is essential today that these things, which are an integral part of people's lives, should receive the widest possible attention. An anthroposophically inclined people, in particular, can make an even more profound study of them. For if we consider that we are members of the anthroposophical movement, we may never forget that it belongs to our innermost feelings to look at everything in such a way that we bring to our observation of the outer phenomena and facts the knowledge that we get from the spiritual world. Not until we become capable of thinking of things as having a spiritual content do they acquire their real face, and we realize that although this spiritual part is initially remaining concealed within the external earthly world, it is nevertheless a living reality. On the previous occasion I was able to be with you here, I gave you a few indications regarding the social impulses at work in human life, which also included the viewpoint of anthroposophical spiritual science. We were then already endeavoring to look at the human being as a social being, as a being possessing both social and antisocial instincts. Only we should never allow ourselves to disregard the fact that as human beings living on this earth, we bring into our earth existence the effects and results of what we experience in the time elapsing between death and a new birth. Each time we return to earthly life, we bring with us the consequences of our last spiritual life, of the last time we resided in the purely supersensible world. And we are not looking at our earthly life in its entirety if we do not bear in mind that what we do and what we experience in the world through coming together with other people has something about it that results from our life in the spiritual world from which we come at birth, traces of which we bring with us as forces into this world. This, on the one hand, is what is projected for us human beings from the spiritual into the physical world. On the other hand, we cannot allow ourselves to disregard that in the life we experience here on earth, things happen to us and around us which do not immediately come fully to consciousness, but of which we take something particularly important with us through the gate of death into the supersensible world, which we experience anew on leaving the earthly world behind at death. Certain things happen to us in our earthly life, the significance of which does not apply to this earthly life, but is rather a preparation for the life after death. If I may use this expression, life after death, as an antonym to life before birth. The way of looking at things which I was speaking about in yesterday's public lecture becomes fully clear only when you can shed the kind of light on it that comes from the supersensible world. And this is the direction I want to be working in today, to deepen anthroposophically the theme that is such a timely one. Let us look at the social problem as one that affects the whole of mankind. However, to us, the whole of humankind is not only the group of souls who come together socially on earth at a particular time, but also the sum of all those souls who at the same time are in the supersensible world, are connected by spiritual ties with earthly human beings, and belong to what we can call the whole of the human race. Let us look first of all at what we call, in an earthly sense, our human spiritual cultural life. Human spiritual life, in an earthly sense, is not the life of spiritual beings, but what we human beings experience in our social togetherness as spiritual life. Everything covered by science, art, and religion belongs here. Also, everything connected with schooling and education belongs here. Let us look first at what human beings in their social togetherness experience as the spiritual life of culture. You know from the sort of information I gave yesterday that this spiritual life, everything covering school, education, science, art, literature, etc., has to form a separate social unit. This can be presented to the outside world only on the basis of reasons they will accept today. It can be perfectly well understood that sound human reason must be totally adequate to understand these things fully. But to see them as they really are is an added bonus to anyone who engages in the anthroposophical way of looking at things. What is called earthly spiritual life appears to someone like this in a very special light. The effect the middle classes, the intellectuals among the middle classes, have had in the course of recent development has been to reduce this spiritual cultural life to a mere ideology, which the working classes are now making use of as such in their worldview, encompassing all the branches I have enumerated. And yet this certainly does not merely arise from out of economic life. The working class view today is namely the following. Everything in the nature of religious conviction and dogma, artistic achievement, and legal or moral views is a superstructure, a kind of spiritual vapor arising out of the only true reality, economic reality. Spiritual life is made into an ideology, into something that is merely in the imagination. To those people, however, who are aware of the foundations from which anthroposophical spiritual science springs, the cultural life in which human beings are embedded is in itself a gift from spiritual beings. They see it not as arising up as clouds out of the depths of economic life, but as streaming down from the life of the spiritual hierarchies. This is the radical difference between what comes from the middle class outlook and its heritage, the working class outlook, according to which everything that has been evolving in humanity since the 15th, 16th centuries is based on the assumption that the spiritual world is ideological, is merely clouds that rise up out of the harmonies and disharmonies of economic life. And that the other outlook, the one which has to come, for this alone can supply the remedy to lead us out of our present-day chaos. Here, the cultural life is seen to stream down out of the real spiritual life of the spiritual world, to which we belong just as much as we belong through our senses and intellect to the physical, earthly world. Having now arrived at the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, we only find our way about in this spiritual life as social beings in the human social organism because before birth and before our descent to earthly existence, we were prepared for it through our connection with other spiritual beings of the hierarchies whom we have often mentioned. Spiritual research reveals this as an important factor of life. Coming into life through our birth, we enter into contact with people in a twofold way. Let us clearly distinguish this twofold approach to other people. One of the ways we relate to others, and we are bound to do this, is through destiny. We meet one or another person, a greater or smaller number of people, by way of connections of destiny. On being born into earthly existence, we enter a particular family. We enter into a karmic connection with our father, our mother, siblings, and the wider family. We become involved in karmic connections with other people, as individuals, on a one-to-one basis. We live out the individual karma we have with other people. How does this karma arise? How do these karmic connections arise? They are the result of previous occurrences taking place in the course of past earthly lives. Take good note of this. When you enter life through birth, the connections of destiny you enter into with other people on a one-to-one basis depend on the kind of experiences you had with them in past lives. This is one of the kinds of relationships you become involved in with other people, relationships of destiny. You also have other kinds of relationship with people. In belonging to a nation, you are part of a group of people with whom you are not karmically connected in the particular way I just described. You were born into a particular part of the earth, as well as a nation. In a way, this certainly has to do with your karma, but you are thrown together in one social organism with a lot of people to whom you do not karmically belong. In a religious community, you may have the same religious aspirations as a number of other people with whom you are certainly not connected karmically. Spiritual life, the earthly sort, obviously produces a great number of social connections among people, which are certainly not all destiny-based. These connections were not all prepared in previous earth lives, but in the period of time you lived through, between death and a new birth. In fact, when you approach the second half of the life between death and a new birth, you enter into a connection with the beings, particularly the higher hierarchies, in which you are influenced by their forces in a way that welds you together spiritually with various human groups. The spiritual life you experience in the form of religion, art, in national connections such as communities based purely on language, in having had a particular kind of education, all this is prepared in the life before birth, in a different realm from that of purely karmic connections. You bring with you into physical earthly existence what you have experienced already in the life before birth. Earthly spiritual life, spiritual cultural life, is a mirroring of what you experienced in the life before birth, although the way you experienced these things then was quite different. Anyone who is able to take a fact of this kind regarding the spiritual world thoroughly seriously, in the full sense of the word, will be faced with a specific question, namely, how can I do justice in the higher sense to this earthly spiritual cultural life now? Now that I know that it is a reflection of what I have already experienced in actual, real, spiritual life before birth. I will do justice to it only by regarding it not as ideology, but as something in which I know the spiritual world lives. We have the right attitude to this earthly spiritual life only when we become aware that in this whole realm we find active forces belonging to the spiritual world. Imagine hypothetically for a moment everything thought by the beings who belong to the supersensible world, what they experience as their soul life, whether it is the beings of the higher hierarchies who never take on an earthly body, or whether it is human beings who have not yet been born, who have not yet passed through the gate of birth into earthly life. Imagine all this living in a dream-like reflection in the earthly spiritual world of culture. We are justified whenever we encounter something, be it in the realm of art, religion, or education, to ask the question, what is living in it? We must not merely be interested in what the people here on earth have been doing, but realize that what lives in them are the forces, thoughts, and impulses belonging to the whole soul life of the higher hierarchies. We are not looking at the world in its wholeness if we deny that our earthly spiritual culture is the reflection of the thoughts of spiritual beings who either never incarnate on this earth or are not incarnated at the present time. If we can become sensitive enough to feel such reverence for the spiritual world surrounding us that we recognize it to be what the spiritual beings themselves are giving us and surrounding us with, then we shall be able to be truly grateful for this gift from the supersensible world, which we experience as our earthly spiritual realm of culture. The cultural realm is then seen necessarily to be an independent branch of the whole social structure of humanity, through the very fact of its being the after effect of what we experience in the spiritual world before birth. If we illumine social life with the light of spiritual knowledge, it becomes an obvious thing to treat this spiritual cultural life as a separate, independent reality. The second area of the social structure in what we could call is what we could call the administrative rights state. Strictly speaking, the political life, the area relating to the ordering of juristic relationships between one person and another, of those things in which everybody should be equal before the law. This is the actual life of the state. And fundamentally speaking, the life of the state should be nothing else but this. You can also certainly see in this area, entirely on the basis of sound common sense, why it is necessary that this branch of the social organism, this life of the state of public law, has to be independent, for it relates to the equality of everyone before the law. In fact, the equality between one person and another altogether. However, when illumined by insight sharpened by anthroposophical spiritual science, we can see something further. This life, the actual life of the state, is the only area within the social organism which has nothing to do with the life before birth or the life after death. This is an area that finds the bearings for all its rulings solely in the world human beings live in between birth and death. The state is true to its own nature only when it does not contain a single element that participates in the supersensible realm, whether in the direction of birth or of death. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. This has to be supplemented by this statement. But do not give Caesar what is God's, nor God what is Caesar's, for God will reject it. These things must be separated as fully as are the systems in our human bodily organism. Everything which the life of the state has the right to include, discuss, and agree to relates solely to the interrelationships between one person and another. That is the essential point. People of all times who are deeply religious have always been sensitive to this. The rest of humanity, those who are not profoundly religious, did not even permit these things to be spoken about honestly and sincerely in public. For a particular idea had settled in the minds of the deeply religious ones. Namely, as far as humankind is concerned, the state encompasses solely those things to do with life between birth and death, things that relate purely to life on earth. It is a bad thing if the area that relates solely to earthly life extends its dominion to things of the supersensible realm, to what lies beyond birth and death. However, the earthly spiritual life does reach beyond birth and death, for it contains the shadow of the soul experience of supersensible beings. If the life pulsing in the state sphere seizes hold of the life of the earthly spirituality, the cultural sphere, the deeply religious ones called this the power exercised by the unlawful prince of this world. This expression, the unlawful prince of this world, is a hidden reference to what I have just indicated. This is the reason why in those circles where there is an interest in mixing together these three branches of the social organism, people are reluctant about or even frown upon mentioning this unlawful prince of the world. It is a somewhat different matter with regard to what happens to the thinking, perception, and soul impulses of people who belong to the economic branch of the social organism. There is something particularly remarkable about this. But anthroposophical spiritual science will have made you used to coming to terms with many a thing that at first sight appears paradoxical. Today, when we speak of the economic branch of the social organism, we must, of course, fully realize that the way we speak of it is characteristic of the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. These things were quite different in earlier periods of the evolution of humanity. What I have to say in this direction applies especially to the present time and the future. And in this context, it has to be said that whereas in earlier ages, people's involvement in the economic sphere was of an instinctive kind, it now has to become more and more conscious. Just as school children learn their mathematical tables and other such things, we must in the future learn in a similar way about the things that relate to the economic branch of the social organism. A person must be able to feel himself to be a member of the economic organism. This may well make some people uncomfortable because of the different kinds of habits of thinking and perceiving which have taken hold of them and which will have to be radically changed. If somebody nowadays did not know what 3 times 9 was, he would be taken for an uneducated person, would he not? In some circles, you would even be considered uneducated if you did not know who Raphael or Leonardo were. But generally speaking today, in most places, you would not be considered uneducated if you could not give a full description of capital or production, consumerism or system of credit. Let alone that hardly anyone has a clear idea of such things as collateral lending. These ideas will certainly change under the impact of social reform, and in the future people will more easily come into a position of wanting to become informed about such things. Nowadays, one does not know where to begin to find a rational explanation of these things. For would it not be the most natural thing to do in order to find out the ins and outs of capital to pick up a textbook on economics by a famous economist? Yet nowadays, if you pick up 3 different textbooks on economics, you will find 3 quite different definitions of what capital actually is. Just imagine what an odd opinion you would have of geometry if you were to pick up 3 geometry books by 3 different writers and find in each one of them the theorem of Pythagoras presented in a different way from the way you yourself had understood it. The situation is that today even the authorities in the field of economics can give one remarkably little information about these matters. So you cannot blame the general public at all if they do not look for it. But information will have to be sought and found. Human beings will have to find the bridge leading them, especially to this economic structure of the social organism. Each one of us will have to make himself consciously the subject of participation in the economy as part of the social organism. We shall learn to think about how we relate to other people simply through the fact of having to handle all kinds of wares on the economic level, and doing this as a community living in a particular territory. The kind of thinking you make use of, one comprising the whole relationship of the natural order to humanity, is quite different from the kind used, for instance, in the sphere of the spiritual culture. In the world of spiritual culture, you share in what beings of the higher hierarchies think, what you yourself have experienced in your life before birth. In the thinking you develop as a member of the social economic struggle, what is constantly happening, however paradoxical this must seem to you, is that another person is thinking along with you, a more profound human being within yourself. The moment you feel yourself to be a member of an economic structure, a more profound person is taking part in your thoughts. You become committed to combine external factors of life by means of thought. You have to think out, what will the price of such and such be? How do I obtain this or that product? Your thoughts jump around over the surface of outer facts. The essence of your thought is not spiritual, but belongs to external material things. And precisely because external material things live in your thinking, precisely because you have to experience in thought and not merely instinctively like an animal what is taking place in the life of the economy, this is why another more profound person is constantly reflecting within you on these things and carrying them further in a way only this more profound person can do, so that they come through to a conclusion and find their relationship to other things. And this is the very same person who plays an important part with regard to all that you take with you through death into the supersensible world. Paradoxical as it appears to some people, it is particularly the thoughts we are forced to think about the material things of the world, specifically because they are never finished, never neatly rounded off, that arouse in us a different kind of inner spiritual life, which we carry through death into the supersensible life. Thus, specifically those perceptions and impulses we acquire in economic life have a stronger connection to our life after death than people imagine. Strange and paradoxical as this may appear today, it is actually the conscious form of what came about in the atavistic ages of human evolution, because it was in those ages that the spiritual world worked into people's instinctive life. I should like to draw your attention to the following. Among some of the so-called primitive peoples, we can discover some astonishing customs. We must not, of course, think such absurd and stupid things about primitive races as present-day anthropologists do. They think that people such as the Australian Aborigines are now at the most primitive stage of humanity, a level at which the present-day civilized races once were. This is nonsense. It is the other way around. What we nowadays call a primitive race is one which has fallen into decadence, which has sunk from another level. Today's primitive peoples have merely preserved customs from earlier ages, which are still present among those so-called civilized people, but in disguise. So primitive peoples give us the opportunity to study some of the habits that existed in a different form in the age of ancient atavistic clairvoyance. For instance, the following custom used to exist. The members of a tribe divided themselves into smaller groups. And each of these smaller groups had a particular name taken from a plant or animal belonging to that area. The significance of attaching to these names was that, for example, one of these groups, which had the name rye, to use the modern term for this grain, had the task of seeing that rye was properly cultivated and that other members of the tribe who did not bear the name of rye were able to obtain supplies. The duty attaching to the people bearing the name rye was to keep an eye on the cultivation and the distribution of rye. The others, who had other names, took it for granted that they would be supplied with rye by this particular group. Another group had the name ox, for instance, and they were responsible for the care of cattle and for supplying the others with cattle and everything attaching to this. Not only did these groups have the duty to supply the others, but the others were at the same time forbidden to cultivate the particular plant or animal concerned, because it was the right of that one totem, as they called it. This is the economic significance of a totem, which in the area that it governed was also a mystery right. These mystery cultures did not apply, as people imagine today, merely to higher realms, the council of the gods, entrusted to those who belonged to the mysteries. These were actually the very foundations upon which details of everyday life were regulated. Via the initiates, or priests, the gods brought order into the tribe through the channel of the totem images, the totem groups, instituting not only the corresponding economic organizations, but also bringing to them, in a manner suitable for the times, a knowledge of the nature of the spiritual world and the part it played in earthly spiritual life. In the same way as they took care of the life of rites with its entirely earthly character, they also prepared human beings by way of economic life, so that when they passed through death, they would be able to enter another world into which they would have to form connections which they could only prepare for here on earth through associating with the kingdoms of nature, external to man. It was under the guidance of these initiates that people of olden times learnt to place a proper economic branch into their life as a whole. Later on, this more or less fell into disorder, although it is not too difficult to point to an instinct of threefoldness of the social organism as far as the time of Greek civilization, or even as late as medieval culture, especially from the viewpoint I've indicated. And the rudiments of this can be found at least as late as the 18th century. Oh dear, a person of today is so lazy in his thinking. People would like to explain everything as superficially as possible. If one were really to study the life of past times, not according to what people today call history, which is frequently an acknowledged untruth, but according to how it actually was, we would then clearly see an instinctive threefoldness. In the one branch, the spiritual cultural life. Everything emanated from a spiritual center, which made it distinctly different from the life of the state. When the Catholic Church was at its greatest, it certainly was an independent limb of society in itself, and organized the rest of earthly spiritual life as a separate department. It founded schools, organized the educational system, even founded the first universities, and kept earthly spiritual life separate, taking care that the life of the state was on no account infiltrated by the unlawful prince of this world. And in the life of the economy, even in later times, there was at least the feeling that if people cultivated brotherliness, amongst themselves in economic life. Something was being prepared that would continue in the life after death. The idea that brotherliness among human beings is rewarded after death is, of course, an egotistical misinterpretation of the nobler images that lived in the totem culture. But at least there was still an awareness of the fact that the existence of mutual brotherliness would continue in a spiritual form in the life after death. Even the excesses in this area must be judged from this point of view. It lies in human nature to go to excess. But one of the most depraved excesses in this area is certainly the trading in indulgences. Even this, though, arose from an awareness that the sacrifices a person makes here in physical life to the life of the economy have significance for his life after death. Even if it is a caricature of the reality, it arose out of the view, though distorted, of the importance of what we experience in this life in relating to the beings of the other kingdoms of the earth, the minerals, plants, and animals. Through becoming involved with these other beings, we acquire something that only comes to full fruition in the life after death. Compared to what we are after death, in the here and now, we are, as human beings, still related to the lower spheres, to animals, to plants, to minerals. But it is precisely through having this experience of the realms of nature outside man that we prepare something that is to develop to the human stage after death. If you look at the thought in this way, you will understand more readily that it is absolutely self-explanatory that what we experience through our involvement with animals, plants, and minerals manifests on earth as something that brings people together, that surrounds them, like a spiritual atmosphere on earth. What human beings experience among themselves founds something between birth and death that is purely etheric. What human beings experience in economic life, in the subhuman sphere, is raised to the level of earthly humanity only after we have passed through death. It should be of the greatest possible interest and significance to everyone endeavoring to deepen their lives by means of anthroposophical spiritual science to reach the recognition that this threefold ordering of the social organism is based on the very fact that a human being is similar to a threefold being. As a child growing into the physical world, we still bear traces of our pre-birth experiences. We have qualities that belong solely to this life between birth and death, and beneath the veil of ordinary physical life, as it were, we are already preparing for what will come into its own in the supersensible realm after death. What appears to be the lowest level of life here, the physical handling of the economy, seemingly lower from our earthly point of view than the life of rites, redresses the balance for us by providing the opportunity for us to gain the time to prepare for life after death. In belonging to the realm of art, religion, learning, and all the other areas of spiritual cultural life, our souls are drawing on the heritage we bring into physical earthly life through birth. But through the fact of descending, as it were, into the subhuman level of economic life, into the kind of thinking that does not reach up to such high levels, the balance is redressed. In that in our deepest inner being, we are preparing for what will only ascend to the human level after death. This may sound paradoxical to a present-day person, because he prefers to regard things from a one-sided point of view and does not want to know that every single thing develops in two directions in life. What is exalted from one aspect is lowly from another, and vice versa. In real life, I could say also in living reality, every single thing has another side to it. A person would know ever so much more about himself and the world if he were aware that everything has its other side. It is uncomfortable sometimes to become fully conscious of this because it brings certain essential duties with it. For instance, with regard to some things, we have to become clever and capable, but we cannot reach this particular measure of capability without unfolding a similar measure of stupidity in another direction. One always requires the other. So even if we meet a person in ordinary life who appears to be stupid, we should never consider him totally stupid, because in his subconscious, there may be deep wisdom hidden away, which we cannot see. We discover reality only when we do justice to these two aspects of existing things. So this is how it is. On the one hand, the life of spiritual culture seems to us to be the higher realm. At the same time, it is the realm in which we are constantly drawing on and exploiting what we bring into physical existence through our birth. And economic life seems to us to be the lowest of the realms. But it fits this description only because during our lifetime it shows us its lowest aspect. It allows us time to develop in our unconscious the spiritual side of economic life, which we take with us through death into the supersensible world. This feeling of belonging in brotherliness with other people is the chief thing we have to understand as being the spiritual part of economic life. Understanding of these things is urgently required if humankind wants to escape from certain calamities which have arisen precisely because things like this have not had any attention paid to them. Something is built up among the leading intellectual personalities of the ruling classes, as I said the day before yesterday, that does not have the impetus to reach into everyday life. It is of especial importance for a person of today to acquire a right understanding in this regard. You see, the leading intellectual circles of the ruling classes have developed a certain moral outlook, a certain religious outlook. But these people prefer to keep this moral, this religious outlook, on a one-sidedly idealistic level. It is not meant to have the motive power to reach into everyday life. This works out practically in that you can visit your church every Sunday or even more often. You will hear sermons there, but these sermons will constantly fail to include the most serious duties of our time. You will be preached to about all sorts of things in the way of how to act out your religiousness, but none of it has any motivating power. So when you leave church and go back to ordinary everyday life, you cannot apply any of what the sermon said about the love of one person for another and what you ought to be doing and what you would like to be experiencing of what they have just been preaching about. Where is there any agreement between what the preacher, the moral teacher, tells his students and the actual prevailing mood in everyday life? Things were different, for example, in those past times to which the totem culture points. What happened then was that initiates organized everyday matters according to the decree of the gods. It is an unhealthy situation to be in that we hear nothing from the pulpits today about how economic life ought to be run. The content of sermons, and I often have used this comparison, is actually similar to speaking to a stove and telling it that its sacred duty is to warm the room and it should get on with it. But you can give a stove this kind of sermon for a very long time and it will not warm the room. All you need to do instead of preaching is to put kindling and coal in it and set it alight, and the room will get warm. You can cut out all the moral teaching that only tell people what they ought to do for the sake of eternal salvation, or for any other things in the category of faith. You can cut out the sort of preaching that most of today's sermons consist of, but you cannot cut out today's real knowledge about the social organism. People who want to educate the masses should see it as their duty to build a bridge, also in the practical realm, between the life and movement in the world of spirit and the things happening in everyday life, for God and everything that bears witness to him lives not only in what people dream about when they are floating in the clouds, but in the most trivial details of everyday life. When you pick up the salt cellar at table, or put a spoonful of soup in your mouth, or purchase something for a few pennies from a fellow human being, all these things bear witness to God's world. But if you entertain the belief that there is solid matter, reality, everything out of a lower nature in one direction, and in the other direction there is the world of God and everything of a spiritual nature, which has to be kept at arm's length from solid matter, because the one is sacred and the other profane, one worthy and the other unworthy, you are contradicting the whole meaning of a world conception that is real and which is the driving force everywhere, in the most exalted holy realm, right down to the sphere of human experience of the most everyday kind. This is what the stream of religion has missed out on right up to our times, when it only beseeches the stove to be warm and frowns upon engaging in real, reliable knowledge of the spirit. If people could only speak frankly and openly about the omission on the part of those people who feel themselves called upon to be leaders in spiritual life to convey this message, it would be a significant indication in the direction of what has to happen. In what way do people often speak today about redemption and about grace, things that are the objects of faith? They speak in a way that makes it very easy for the masses. There they are with their believing souls. Christ Jesus died on Golgotha, and the progressive theologians do not believe this any longer nowadays. He rose again. But he did it all for himself, and human beings need do nothing more than believe it. A great many people think this way today, and they regard it as an intrusion into their sphere if anyone thinks differently. But people must learn to think differently. Precisely in this realm, a radical turnabout has to happen. At this moment in time, there sounds forth to us once again the counsel of Christ, which was also the message of John the Baptist. Change your way of thinking, for the time of crisis is at hand. People have become used to taking it for granted that the Spirit is somewhere around looking after them. Their religious preachers keep telling them there is this kind of spiritual world of which, however, they give the minimum description. People do not want to make the least effort to know anything about the spiritual world, but only to have belief in it. It is no longer permissible to act in this way. The time has to start right now, in which it is imperative to know. Not only do I think about things, possibly also about supersensible matters, but I must make way for divine spiritual forces to be in my thinking and my experiencing. The spiritual world must live in me. My very thoughts must become godlike. I must give this divinity the chance to speak through me. Then spiritual life will no longer be merely an ideology. That is the great sin of modern times, that spiritual life is reduced to the impotence of ideology. Theology today has become ideological, For it is not only the working class socialist outlook that is an ideology. It is essential that human beings recover from this ideology. The spiritual world has to become real to them. They have to realize that on the one hand, the spiritual world is a real factor living in the one sphere of the social organism in the form of a heritage of the life lived in the spirit world before birth. And that on the other hand, a spiritual factor is being prepared while we immerse ourselves in economic life, which seems to be below the human level. As compensation for this immersion, the very capacity of being prepared, which in the life we shall enter when we return through death into the spiritual world, shall lead us, if we experience this properly, to a more human, brotherly knowledge when we are here on earth. What must come about is that we look at life as it is in reality. An adherent of anthroposophical spiritual science will find his right place in the world if he becomes aware that things that have without fail to enter the stream of humankind can become something much more profound for him if anthroposophy is recognized and cultivated as something that is much more than a science cultivated. In fact, as something that enters into and transforms all his responses to life so that he can become a worthy and proper part of what has to start in the present time and which is the only thing that can bring healing for the future of humanity. These words are a pronouncement of what is essential for humanity, but also a pronouncement of what humanity has neglected to do. Only by becoming fearlessly and courageously involved in what has been neglected and which must of necessity be tackled, can anything of a healing nature be brought about for the present age and the immediate future. This is why, here, where we are gathered together privately, I have endeavored, in addition to what can be said publicly about the social question, to present these things that are the particular contribution of anthroposophical spiritual science, in that we can include the aspects that penetrate into this earthly life from the supersensible realm of eternal life. One branch only of the social organism, the one related to the organization of outer life by the state, is of purely earthly nature. The two other branches are bound up with supersensible forces in two different directions. On the one hand, a spiritual cultural life has been allotted us as a spiritual earthly life, which, because it is, as it were, brought out of the super earthly life we pass through before birth, this can be experienced as a surplus. And on the other hand, because we are people of flesh and therefore connected with the earthly animals, we must submerge ourselves in the life of plain economy. Yet through the fact that we are not solely people of flesh, but in this fleshly body, the soul is preparing itself for the following earth life and for the following supersensible life, preparations are also being made in our economic life, which, like a kind of springboard, will enable the part of us which is not yet entirely human, namely the part of us which has to work in economic life, to ascend to the human level. We have, as it were, something in us of a superhuman being, in as far as we can enter a social connection that pervades earthly, spiritual, cultural life. Part of us is entirely on a purely human level, in that we become citizens of the state, and part of us forces us to descend below either of these levels, but at the same time we are recompensed by the supersensible world through the fact that in what appears to our social awareness to be the lowest member of the social organism, an element is being prepared that will lead us out of it and reincorporate us into the supersensible domain. Reality, of course, cannot be grasped on as superficial and simple a level as we would sometimes wish. On the contrary, what it shows us is that human life goes through a great variety of phases, of which each phase contributes some new impulse, some new ingredient to human life, which can only be acquired in this particular way. Thus, we see the way in which the strands of life we live here, between birth and death, are intertwined with those strands we bring into play in our life between death and a new birth. And in the whole span of human existence, everything fits together with the greatest possible meaning. Furthermore, what we set going here in earthly life between one individual and another, what we do to another human being by bringing him joy or sorrow, enriching his thoughts or impoverishing them, by having various dealings with him, these things prepare our karmic life for our next incarnation. But we have to distinguish this from what is essential to us for our preparation for the supersensible part of existence that we unfold directly after death. Here we are brought into certain social communities, but we have to be extricated. Oh, I think this means here on earth, we are brought into certain social communities. But we have to be extricated from them again. And this happens in that from the very life of the economy, something emerges which leads us through the gates of death into the spiritual world so that we do not remain in the same social community that we became connected with here, but are enabled to be accepted into another one in our next life. This is how meaningful the karmic strands of our life intertwine with the strands that place us into general world existence. What we can gain for threefolding of the social order by combining, with the help of spiritual science, the supersensible element with physical earthly life, this appears to deepen to a significant extent what will have to become the exoteric content concerning the threefold social order. It certainly seems to deepen it considerably, though there is simply no help today that for outside people this is difficult to understand. Someone who is in the anthroposophical movement ought always to include alongside everything that has its justification in the earthly realm all those things that connect us with the sphere we enter after death and from which we come at birth, the sphere in which we find those who are departed from this world ahead of us and with whom we have a definite relationship. For the finest human achievement arising out of our involvement with anthroposophy will be that it teaches us to penetrate the two great mysteries of earthly life, birth and death, creating a bridge between the sense world and the supersensible world, between the so-called living and the so-called dead, so that what is dead becomes as something alive among us. And we can say of the living, the life that was ours in the supersensible realm before birth and will be ours after our death is nothing else but a different form of existence. Things are dead in the sense world, in the same way that the sense world is dead to us when we are living in the supersensible world. The connection between the things of the world is relative. And when we penetrate these two sides of each and every reality, then we shall have reached reality itself. This is what I wish to bring to you as an addition, as an esoteric rounding off of those problems which it is now so urgently necessary to present to the public, and which those people who are closely connected with anthroposophical life should take an active interest in.